Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime, to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private eye and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you have a friend or a family member and you would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case and you'd like to be considered for a future segment on a show, please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com.
And tonight our first guest is Dwayne T. Bowers. Dwayne is a traumatic loss therapist and educator in private practice. His work includes individual and group therapy as well as retreat facilitation. As an educator, he teaches workshops, seminars, and courses nationally and internationally and through a variety of media to professionals who provide support to victims of trauma and grief. Dwayne, welcome to CrimeWire.
Thank you, Denny. It's good to be back.
Great to have you. And if you want more information about Dwayne and his work, you can check out his website at www.dwayne, that's D-U-A-N-E, T as in Tom, Bowers, B-O-W-E-R-S.com. That's DwayneTBowers.com. Dwayne, you know, on this show, we profile a lot of cases of homicides and suspicious death cases. And I personally, and also Vito and Susan, speak with the families of the victims. I've experienced the loss of a daughter, not to those situations, but to an accident. And I know that as we approach certain dates, it's a little tougher to deal with the loss. No matter how long ago it was, it's still there. And as we approach Christmas time, that's one of those dates that can be tough on the families. Do you have any tips? Is there anything people can do to make it easier or less painful to get through the holidays or these special dates when their loved ones are more on their minds than normal?
I'm not sure there's a way we can make it less painful, but I think there are ways that we can cope with the holidays better. You know, what I have found is folks tend to fall into a couple of categories. They, if they're having a hard time dealing with the holidays, some folks want to pretend like nothing happened. Let's just go through Christmas like we always did, or the holidays, and just pretend like nothing has happened. And so there's this elephant in the room. And then another extreme is that folks just want to cancel the holidays. We're just not going to celebrate the holidays. And there's probably a place kind of in between that is more comfortable for folks. First of all, one of the things that folks do all the time is they're afraid that, well, I won't bring up, you know, the deceased person. I won't bring up grandpa's name. I won't talk about grandpa because I don't want grandma to cry. I don't want to make her feel bad. Well, you know, the bottom line is that everybody feels bad anyhow. They already feel bad. Bringing up the name isn't going to cause them to feel bad. Bringing up the name actually allows them to talk about the person and to talk about how they're missing the person during this holiday. So that idea of, well, let's just act like nothing happened can really make things worse. I've actually had clients who said, you know, I spent the whole Thanksgiving with the family, and not once did anyone mention, you know, my husband or whatever, and how horrible that was that they didn't even mention him. So when we think we're actually making it easier on the person closest to the decedent, very often by not mentioning the person, we're actually, they feel we're disrespecting them. So I think there's a way of scaling back on the holidays, acknowledging that the person's not there, acknowledging that we're all feeling different because they're not there, and still participate in the holidays, just maybe not to the same degree that we would have before. So kind of answering your question, I sort of tap-danced around it, and I'm sorry. I think there are ways that we can cope. It doesn't reduce the pain, but it makes it a little easier to get through the holidays. Let me make one more point. So many times I've had people say to me after the holidays were over, I expected them to be much worse than they were. Very often people anticipate that the holidays are going to just be so horrendous. And it ends up that by doing some positive coping, they were able to get through it, and it wasn't as painful as they thought it would be.
What about somebody that's missing, that they don't have answers for yet, and they can't celebrate? They can't. I noticed that Morgan Harrington's family had an answer. It wasn't closure. It's just the acceptance of the fact that they had found her body in January of this past year, and they've been on our show, and I looked over their blog today, and I saw that it was different for them last year because they didn't have an answer, but yet, how do they proceed?
It really is very different when you've got a missing person, and then when the person is found. There's actually a shift that has to be made. One of the things, when the person is missing, there is always that anticipation of what if. In other words, there's always this dual sense of thinking that, all right, we're going to go ahead with Christmas because they might come back. But if they don't come back, we're still going to go ahead with Christmas. I mean, there's sort of a dual sense of planning when a person is missing. Here's what I'll do if they come back. Here's what I do if they don't. That has to shift into accepting the fact that they won't come back when the remains are found, when the loved one, when it's clear that the loved one is not still living. And
so in a sense, does then the empty place at the table kind of be still kind of there, kind of like the person's coming, they're going to set the place for that person as if they're going to walk in the door, and then perhaps if they get the news that didn't happen, then it just totally changes for them?
It does. But, you know, one of the coping mechanisms we use for people who have a loved one who's deceased is to go ahead and set that place in honor of them, or if not set a place, then put a candle at their place, light the candle in honor of them so that their place is still reserved and still a point of honor, but that there's not the expectation they're going to eat the meal. So the shift comes from thinking that they might, if they're not here this year, they might be here next year, to knowing that they're not going to be in that place. And so there has to be a real relocation of the loved one, relocating them from the present to a future of no physical interaction, but perhaps spiritual, perhaps emotional interaction, and relocating them from the physical plane to a more spiritual plane or a more emotional one.
How do you explain that to younger children?
It depends on the age of the child, because younger kids, one of the mistakes we make with children is we think that they get the concept of death, and very often they don't. Little kids, particularly when we're saying that, you know, grandma went to be with God, I actually know of a case where the little girl went up to her room, packed her suitcase, came downstairs and sat on her suitcase, and said, "What's up, honey? What are you doing?" "Well, I'm waiting for us to go visit God. I mean, last year, you know, Aunt Hazel married her boyfriend and they moved to Akron, so I'm waiting to go travel to see God and Grandma." So they don't understand when we use these terms of heaven and whatever that we're talking about something that's not tangible. So with little kids, you really have to talk about tangible, that Grandma's body doesn't work anymore, and that's forever, and that we're not, you know, she's not here with us in the present anymore. And you really can't talk about she's watching over us, because then the little kid thinks, well, she is somewhere. Let's go see her. So you have to be really tangible with little kids. And then as they get older, they can accept more and more the idea of something, some concept of a heaven or some concept of a spirit, something that's not tangible. But you have to know the age of the child and what they can comprehend. One of the best ways to do that is listening to the questions that they ask. Kids are very good at telling you what they don't understand by the questions they ask if you're listening to them and not listening to yourself. I'm going to say one more thing and then stop. Very often what adults do with children is they treat children in a, we don't want to hurt, so we say we're protecting the child. But what's really going on is we're protecting ourselves and we're protecting our own feelings. So, well, I'm protecting the child. I'm not going to tell her exactly what's going on, or I'm not going to tell her that grandma's in the process of dying or whatever. So we tend to, in the name of protecting children, actually protect our own feelings. And then the child ends up confused and has to kind of fill in the blanks themselves.
What about, you know, Vito, you're a first responder. You've been on crime scenes and such grief. And how are you able to deal a lot of times with the families that you come in contact with?
It's a tough situation, Susan and Dwayne. I get people in my office sometimes a day or two after their son was killed. And, I remember asking one of the fathers one day, I said, you know, how you doing, John? And he said to me, I got to be good friends with this guy after working the case for several years for him. He says, Vito, you know, I go to work, I take care of my business, I, you know, laugh a little bit, I go and eat, but I do it all in a cloud. He says, I do everything I'm supposed to do in the day, but it's kind of like I'm in a fog. That's the word he used. I'm in a fog all day long. I just kind of move from one thing to the other. And I, you know, that type of a thing. I've seen people in my office that can't even concentrate on talking to me. They look around the room. I have to try to, especially with fathers more than mothers. That's what I've seen. Now, that doesn't mean anything. And it's difficult. You have to really be very sensitive. I thank God that I'm a lot more sensitive now than I was. I've been a private detective 21 years, more sensitive than when I was a gruff police officer that would show up at the scene and the dead body would be there from a heart attack or an overdose or something, and now the family's coming in one by one and stand back, just everybody stand back, wait for the medical examiner, and that kind of an attitude. So, you know, hopefully you change and you know how to handle people the proper way. Is that kind of correct, Dwayne?
Sure, absolutely. And a traumatic loss, you've got another whole set of things going on with the family members and the survivors. In a traumatic loss, they are actually experiencing trauma. So there's a whole different set of neurochemistry going on, which causes them to have difficulty in recall immediately after. It causes them to have trouble processing what has happened. And,
well, they're numb. They can't see past, you know, your feet. I've said this a lot of times. Your feet are not on the ground. Once you've been involved in a violent, traumatic murder, and you're there at the crime scene, and you feel like you're watching, and mm-hmm. you're not even there. And then even afterwards, and the people that leave you, that say that they're going to be around, that say they're going to help you, everybody just vanishes from your life. And that makes it worse. That adds insult to injury. It's almost as if you did something wrong. And that's very difficult for these families. And it's
Susan,
very difficult for the person.
And Susan, people have to be very careful when they say to someone, anything you need, I'll be there for you. Anything
oh, please,
you
I'm
want.
I'm still waiting 20-some years. Come on.
You know? Yeah, well, what I mean by that is that don't say it to somebody unless you really mean it. Because that will hurt a person more when that person may call you for what they consider a simple favor, and you can't do it for them for whatever reason.
And, you hold on to that,
sure.
You know, Vito and Denny. You remember that stupid little thing? You remember that what they promised you? Because, you know, the person that was there for you, or that you were, you know, especially when you grow up with all these people, and they're part of your life, they're part of your childhood, they're part of your, you know, teenage years or your adulthood, and the people around you that were your blanket, were your life. I always say that when you lose an important member of your family, it's like losing your country. It's a place that no longer exists because you cannot go back to it. And that's something that people don't understand. And you do. Like I said, it's 27 years. I still remember so-and-so promising me something. Well, you know, I doubt they're listening, but wherever they are, I'm still waiting.
Wayne, I got a question maybe you could help me with. It seems to me, I always thought, you know, the natural progression of things, the way it's supposed to be, is the older people, the older generations die off, you know, and your kids always outlive you and that type of thing. And obviously it doesn't work that way all the time. And a lot of our listeners have lost children, okay? And sometimes to make that even worse, the cases are ruled to be suicides, and the parents or the family members have strong reason to believe that they were actually homicides. And so that they're not only experiencing the loss of their loved one, in these cases, something that's out of whack. It's not supposed to happen that way. You're supposed to go first, and the kids are supposed to outlive you. And now they've got the other stress, is that they're quite confident somebody is getting away with murder because the system perhaps has let them down. When you're in that type of situation, what does that add, if anything, to the grieving process? I mean, are all losses as grieving the same, or when there are other circumstances, such as the loss of a child and a possibility that the justice system has failed you,
mm-hmm.
does that make it worse, or does it have any effect on the grieving?
When my loved one dies as a victim, where I feel that it was at the action of someone else, the grieving is complicated, and actually it's not only complicated, it is blocked.
It's compounded, I think.
Well, it gets blocked by the rage and the anger. And if a person starts putting a lot of emphasis into the perpetrator, I got to make sure that the bad guy gets caught, gets dealt with, et cetera, actually, not only does it block my grieving, it's actually helping me to avoid grieving. And many people will put a lot of resources into the anger and the rage and to make sure justice gets done before they will allow themselves to feel through the pain of the loss. And so it really does very often block the grieving process. You'll hear this all the time where maybe it's been 2-3 years, finally the perpetrator's caught, he goes to trial, and he's found guilty. And you'll hear in an interview the family members say, finally, we can grieve. And they really mean that. They never really felt through the pain of the loss because all of their energy was in this anger and this rage and this injustice, trying to make this justice happen. And if the justice doesn't happen, if I get all enraged and I start putting all of my emphasis on a perpetrator or a system that didn't serve me, then I never do really grieve the loss. And for some folks, that's kind of some folks do that to avoid feeling the pain of the loss. It's much easier for us to feel anger and rage than it is to feel pain. And so some folks will focus on that, and really to really grieve the loss, they have to kind of let go of that part of it to be able to feel through all the pain of the person not being there, of not being there to fill the roles. Another thing that happens when you've got kids who die before adults, see, adults should be watching their children meet all of these different expectations, all these different developmental roles. And when a child suddenly is removed from me and doesn't meet those roles, I have to grieve not only the memory of the child, but I have to grieve the expectations I had for the child. That's very painful. That's very difficult to do. And that's why grieving as an adult, grieving your child, is much different than grieving the loss of an adult who has aged and died naturally of old age. Because there are no expectations to grieve there. They lived a full life. So we grieve the memories. Parents have to grieve both.
you know, you're right. Or in some cases, too, there's a lot of murder victims through missing persons victims through the years that I've dealt with that have said to me, and I didn't think about this. I had never thought I would go past my mother's age of 47, ever. And I remember talking to Alice Donovan and a couple other people that who finally had some closure. But before their loved one was discovered, I said, how old was your mother when she died? I said, are you that age? She goes, no, not yet, but I never could see myself going past that age of 35 or 40 years old. And it seems like the victims who are waiting or who lose somebody so tragically, they don't think past that age of their mother and father. They can't see it.
Particularly if it's a mother or father, because who gives us the role modeling of how we're supposed to live our older years? Who is it that we learn how to age from and how to live older years from? So when I get to that age, now I don't have anybody to compare myself to. I don't know what I'm supposed to do after this age because my mother or father wasn't there to live through it before me so I could see how they lived it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So how then do you tell someone, because they really can't see it. They can't.
Yeah.
They have no comprehension. Even some of these cases where the families are wiped out, they have no. You know, they're the surviving, and they have no comprehension past that age of mm-hmm. of anyone to gauge.
This is a good time to look at other role models. Look at people around you because. Somebody, you know, we always look for people to fill those vacant roles. So are there people in your life that are of that age, and are they living a life that you would consider an acceptable life? Can you look at them and say, okay, that part of their life, that I would like to do, that I would like to accomplish. Can you find other people to fill those roles?
Can I make a comment about that then? What happens that I have seen is that it's you don't want to be around anybody who would be that age, or you don't want to be around somebody else's mother or somebody else's father, that the holidays are really difficult. It's not that you don't feel like it's okay. You feel naked when you walk in. And somebody's trying to be overly nice or make a favorite dish for you, and you're kind of insulted a little bit because you look at it like, well, you know, this is nice, but it's not my ma, and you would rather go and hide or not show up than participate.
Mm-hmm. Although one of William Warden, who was one of the movers and shakers in the field of grief, he says one of the tasks of grieving is actually looking at the roles that our loved one filled in our life, all of those roles, and then figuring out who's going to fill those roles for us. So I think it's a matter of us taking the initiative. When somebody's kind of trying to play a role in our life, and we didn't give them permission to do it, yeah, we're not going to take to that so well. But when it's us saying, you know, there's a person that's living a life I would like to live. There's a person that can teach me to do thus and so.
But I don't think that you see that because in the grieving process or the post-traumatic stress of it, I don't think that we think like that.
Mm-hmm. I have seen clients who have. So,
okay.
Yeah, where they tend. And in fact, very often I have seen clients move almost in an unhealthy way into, particularly if a parent died, moving almost in an unhealthy way into a relationship with someone, a wife, husband, whatever, expecting them to play the role of mother or father and having to deal with that because that is unhealthy. So they put the expectation on somebody else to fill the role sometimes. So I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that sometimes I do see the opposite where they tend to really grasp onto someone to fill that role.
Hey, Dwayne,
mm-hmm.
just a question or really an observation. And looking at your website here where it says when to seek professional help for emotional or psychological trauma, for myself, what happened as a police officer, myself and my partner were involved in a shootout with two other men, one who wound up dying from his wounds and the other one being wounded. And during that era of the police department, there was no psychological help or nothing even offered to you. The most they did to me was take tomorrow off and come in you know, come in the next day. And what happened was 8 or 10 years later, under what you have here, it's a good idea to seek professional help if you're. And the thing for me was what you say here about experiencing terrifying memories, nightmares, or flashbacks. And that's what had happened to me about 8 or 10 years later. It got so bad that I had to, met with a Christian psychologist for several months and basically just talked and walked me through it. And that was many years ago. And nothing has ever come back from then. So I guess people kind of start it much earlier, closer to the trauma. Some people, once they have the trauma, I would imagine maybe go through it for the rest of their life. Is that correct, without getting rid of it?
Absolutely, absolutely, particularly if they don't get help. And you know where we're seeing it, certainly, and I'm moving this kind of out of our context, but you see this with war vets,
right,
where they never went to get help. And, you know, we still have you know, a third of the homeless men on the street right now are still Vietnam vets, and they're on the street because they spun out of the conventional living situation. They weren't able to deal with it, and so they end up losing jobs, losing families, whatever. So, yeah, that's a perfect example right there.
Yeah, I mean, that's a shame that has to be for especially somebody in a war like they were to wind up on the street and, you know, begging for coins after they went out to protect us, you know.
Absolutely. And in fact, when you see family members totally withdrawn and you know, losing jobs and whatever, but they're totally withdrawn, like you said, it doesn't have to be as a result of war. It can be any traumatic event, and certainly the traumatic loss of a loved one. You can have those exact same reactions. Hopefully we've come a little further, though, than when you were needing the help.
Right.
I think the field has really moved ahead. The mental health field has moved ahead in leaps and bounds in understanding PTSD and working with it much differently now, understanding that it's not just an emotional response, but it is also a physiological response and dealing with both aspects of it.
I mean, it's amazing, Dwayne, because, you know, what seems like a long time ago for me when that happened is not really in the whole scope of things, you know, 30, a little over 30 years or something like that. And, you know, all they did back then, they pinned medals on your chest and you did a good job and, you know, go back to work. And, you know, sometimes you don't know what the future is going to bring for you. I mean, there was, all the police reports say there was over 30 shots fired and, you know, real traumatic experience. And at the time, it didn't bother me at all. I just figure, well, that's done with now, you know. But it's amazing, and I can see why those poor soldiers that come back, and I don't put myself in any category as those people that fought for the country, that it's a shame that the trauma they have to go through in their lives, you know.
So
what about somebody taking care of somebody that's sick, that is, you know, this is the holiday, and maybe it's the last time the person's going to be there? Is there a process that they should take as they're going through this and doing the final stages of life care with someone?
Absolutely. Let me make one more point to what was just said, though. So take the military personnel, take the law enforcement personnel who are exposed to these kind of trauma and look at the reaction that they have to them. Now, take that to a parent who watched their child get gunned down on the street or was the one that walked in and found the child hanging, you know, as a result of suicide or whatever, and imagine, because they are in an environment that did not anticipate in any way finding this kind of an event, where with military and law enforcement, there's always the possibility you will see that kind of scene. Take it to a person who never, ever anticipated that kind of scene, and then imagine how that plays for them and how that trauma plays for them. And if they don't get help, they're going through exactly what you just described. So,
you know, Dwayne, that's a very good point, because when you're in the Army, when you're in the services, you're trained to go to war. You know that could and maybe very well can happen. Police officer, right from the police academy, you're trained by your shooting and everything else that you do that the day could come where the bad guy comes out of a bank or whatever kind of circumstance. But when something comes out of the blue, like you just said, those are the people I see in my office, and those are the people I saw as a cop that just, you know, never woke up that morning never expecting anything like that.
And if I am a victim in that respect, who do I go to that's had the same kind of experience? If I'm law enforcement, if I'm military, at least there's some other folk out there that may have had the same experience. But if I'm Joe Blow on the street, if I'm Jane Blow on the street, who do I turn to? And there are groups of folks, you know, parents of murdered children, et cetera, but you have to find them. And that can be a hard struggle for folks to get to that point.
That's a good point.
To your question about if someone is ill and perhaps terminally ill, one of the things that we teach for folks who are being caregivers to someone who is in the process of dying is to accept the loved one every day for who they are that day. One of the things that allows us to do is as the disease moves more and more toward death, things are going to happen. They're going to lose physical abilities. They're going to lose cognitive abilities. And so if I accept my loved one every day for who they are, I'm grieving the losses as they occur rather than kind of holding on to this image of who they used to be through this whole process. And then when they die, I have to grieve the whole process. This idea of anticipatory grief where I'm grieving as I'm moving through the dying process with my loved one. I'm grieving as it happens. And what that really does is when the point of death comes, it really eases the grieving process after the death a little bit because I've been grieving being with my loved one, accepting them for who they are on a daily basis, not putting expectations on them, not hoping that they'll miraculously get better and return to who they were, but really accepting them on a daily basis for who they are, spending as much time as you can, interacting with them on whatever level they can interact on to the best of their ability, and creating human experiences is important too. Because when someone is dying, you can remember every medical procedure and every medication because I was the one that had to take them there and whatever. But if you don't create some human memories in the process, then when the loved one dies, all you've got is the medical ones. And you don't remember the last time I held her hand, or I can't remember the last time I sat and read to him or whatever. So it's really important to create human memories while your loved one's in the process of dying, so that when the death has occurred, when you think back over it, you can balance all the medical stuff with some of the human interaction that you had with them.
Dwayne?
Mm-hmm.
Dwayne, we've run out of time already here. I certainly want to thank you for joining us, and I hope you'll come back with us again sometime.
Anytime, Denny. I enjoy being with you.
Okay, thank you, folks, and then thank you, Dwayne. And again, Dwayne's website is www.dwaynetbowers.com. Thanks, Dwayne, and Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you. You too.
Well, that was a very interesting segment, and we're going to go on to our next guest now. Our next guest is Jason Brown. He's the founder and CEO of Teen Track. Jason is an investigator licensed in Arizona and Colorado. He is a military veteran and is currently serving his third term as an appointed hearing officer judge in the Maricopa County Justice Courts in Phoenix, Arizona. He has more than 20 years of experience in mitigating corporate risk and resolving potential complex legal conflicts. Jason founded and served as CEO of Jason Brown PLLC, an Arizona licensed investigative agency. In 2009, Jason was appointed to the Arizona Foster Care Review Board, which oversees the care for children placed within the foster care program. Welcome to CrimeWire, Jason.
I think his line might be muted.
Okay, there we go.
Hello.
Hello.
Jason?
Yes, sir.
Welcome to CrimeWire. Did you hear my introduction for you?
Yes, I did, sir.
Okay, well, welcome to our show. Why don't you tell our listeners across the country a little bit about Teen Track, first of all, what it's about and what you try to do with it.
Okay, Teen Track USA is an organization we started last year in November in 2009 to kind of deal with the issue of these runaways and missing children. But we developed the company to get runaways off the street, to take away the supply for the human smuggling, the sex trade industry. But we also found that when we take these children off the street, we needed some type of component to help them reunite back with their families. So we collaborate with local counselors, actually throughout the United States, with counselors to help, once we locate the children, to reunite them back in and provide counseling for parents and for the missing child.
We just saw Elizabeth Smart's human trafficker or sex predator just get convicted for what he did and how he held her for the amount of years. Are you seeing on the streets now that human trafficking is a lot larger than people really understand?
I don't think it's larger, but I think it does exist. I was just in a meeting last week with Phoenix Police Vice Squad, and they recovered 8 trafficking victims last month, which is a smaller number than I would expect, but that's pretty much what we're hearing and what we're seeing in our victims. Our teens, if I recover 30 children, maybe 3 to 5 were trafficked. So, I mean, the numbers
are... That's still
a
lot.
That is a lot. I'm in a major city of Phoenix, but, I mean, you would think by the media and by everything, there would be a greater number. And we're just not seeing it yet.
But is it more because it's a term we're not identifying with these kids? When people say human trafficking, I don't think that they get the concept of what that means.
I totally agree with you. We definitely are misassociating that issue. I mean, we call it teen prostitution. We call it a lot of different things when it's actually traffic. I mean, teens.
What is the definition of traffic? What is, so people understand that are listening?
Traffic is someone that's being held against their will, promoted or sold for the purpose of money. And right now, I mean, the national stats are saying that, you know, each victim is worth $250,000 on the street. So, I mean, it's just going to get worse. It's not going to get better.
Denny, when you were coming up in the ranks, did you see a lot of kids that were just that went missing that were into, you know, that got sold into this type of trade?
In the particular area I was in, I didn't see that. Now, I did not say it didn't happen, and maybe it just wasn't understood what was happening. But our main problem seemed in the rural area I was in was kids running away, running away from home, and then to support themselves voluntarily, or at least as far as we can determine, voluntarily getting into, to the sex business to earn money, and so they could survive on the streets and have some type of income. And it wasn't, as far as I know, the compulsory or the forced selling and trafficking angle wasn't as prevalent in my area back then. I don't know what it is today. But do you find, Jason, that a lot of kids, and that was what happened back 20 years ago, what I'm talking about, does that still happen today? Do some of these kids, maybe they're in a fight with their parents or what have you, they decide to bail out of the house, and they, you know, 14, 15, whatever, and they don't have money, they don't really have an income, and once they get out there on their own, they haven't pre-planned, they don't know what to do, and the sex trade would be one, probably something they could get into fairly easily if they were so inclined to make money. Does that happen a lot?
Well, yeah, definitely children will, within 24 to 48 hours, start using their resources that they have, their bodies, I mean, whatever they have, home invasions, burglaries, whatever, to fund themselves to stay out on the street. I haven't seen any of our victims, of our runaways, electing to go into the human smuggling or the sex trade industry. I see that they're lured away and they're kind of like captured at that point, or that they have recruiters out there recruiting these runaways, because they're an ideal demographic, because nobody's looking for them. And the police aren't looking for them, because in the majority of the states, it's not considered a crime. So law enforcement doesn't aggressively try to recover them. So nobody's looking for them. So it's a perfect victim for these predators to get them, because nobody's looking for them. So there's no fear of someone coming after them.
So, how can a parent be prepared and to protect their kids? Is there such a thing to be able to do for them? Is there, can they protect them?
You know, if they're in the home, yes. If they're out there as a runaway on the street, no. I mean, the street will take them eventually, though, for crimes or for the sex or for whatever. I mean, the street will usually take the children at some point. And I guess my thing is, I'm afraid of when a teen does elect to leave home, I mean, on their own and become a runaway, they usually do it for a reason. And I like to say that children are lured away from home, not that they just walk away. But let's say that they get out there, they're with a boy or girl, and that works out good for a short period of time. And then all of a sudden, that doesn't work out. They start jumping circles of friends. And then they get into a circle of friends that they're not familiar with, and that's when the trouble begins. I mean, generally, you run away with somebody that you trust and that you know. After that, once that disintegrates and you go to another group of friends, then you become preyed upon by the people in the group. And I see that a lot that happens, especially with runaways that are gone greater than the 24 to 48 hour period of time.
Jason, did you have a Utah case you wanted to mention on the show tonight that you're working on?
Yeah, this is Katie Allison. She was in Logan, Utah, going to a treatment program there. She's 17 years old, really bright child, has some disabilities. She's made a decision to run away, and at this point we've tracked her from Logan, Utah, to Ogden, Utah. We know that she, from there, took a Greyhound bus to Portland, Oregon, and then went back to Kenosha, Wisconsin, which is where she's from. Well, not Kenosha, but the area of southeastern Wisconsin. That's her area that she was raised in. So we know that she's back in that area, and I'm actually in transit right now, getting back to Wisconsin to start searching for her in the Wisconsin area.
So it's just over the Illinois border. That's Lake Geneva. You know, that's by what's that big amusement park? Gurnee, Illinois, out that way.
It's actually Racine, Oak Creek, in that area.
Burlingame.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So what we're believing right now is that she's hanging out with maybe college-age kids are on their own, that she could basically sleep on their couch, or as you guys know what couch surfing is. She's probably just, I mean, sleeping on people's couches here and there and maybe trying to get a job. And we know that she did alter her appearance by cutting her hair and dyeing her hair. She did that in Portland. But, I mean, we're right now searching some leads that we have with Greyhound, getting some videos so we can actually get the photos of what she looks like now.
Jason, how do you and your group get involved with the cases? I mean, what are the sources of referrals to get you actively trying to find these kids?
Well, we actively go out and educate our communities in Colorado, Utah, and Arizona about what we do. And generally, referrals come from word of mouth from somebody else, whether it's from another advocate or activist in this industry, or a school, the SROs, the school resource officers, the school counselors, or private counselors. Those are who tells parents about us, and then they contact us.
And do you generally, I assume, did you work with law enforcement in these various communities or locations where your searches lead, or are you pretty much independent? Or
no, we actually collaborate with law enforcement. Law enforcement is so important in recovering these children fast. They have some resources. We have some resources. It really works good hand in hand. For instance, Utah State University Police, they're an amazing organization. In Utah, it's not a crime to run away. But this organization or this law enforcement agency wants to find every child. And that's their their little thing is nobody's going to be out on the street. They actively look. They support us. We support them. I mean, law enforcement agencies really are supporting this whole effort to bring home runaways. I mean, we all have children, so we all know what it's like not to have our child at home. So law enforcement officers, I mean, are always there to help. And they're always, I mean, they throw in their resources. And it's just an amazing process that we've developed. We do work really hand-in-hand with law enforcement.
Denny?
Oh, volunteer? I'm sorry, Rita.
No, that's okay. Go ahead. Finish up.
I was just wondering, is your group all volunteer, or do you have some, you know, regular staff, or who helps you?
Well, we have all of the above. We have a board advisory board that works with our runaway side. They are a diverse group of business people from the Phoenix area and around the country, including law enforcement in states that allow them to work on the off-duty. Those people actually will go on the street with us. We've licensed them as private investigators, with an exception of the law enforcement officers that are on the board, because they don't need to be licensed. They already are licensed by their trade. There are volunteer investigators that are licensed as investigators. Throughout the country, we have volunteers, like in Iowa, we have a girl up there, Stephanie. She's amazing. She handles some of our social networking, some of our, some of our logistics. We have another volunteer down in just south of Nashville, Tennessee, Kathy Ann. She is amazing on Facebook. She gets the word out, gets volunteers. I mean, it's just volunteers are the only way we can do this. I mean, we do charge money to parents that can afford to help in their effort or in their child's effort, and then there's parents that can't afford it. We help everybody.
And
why don't you talk about the importance of the internet? Because last week, you know, we talked about Brittany Mae Smith. We opened the show with it, and then I did a bunch of other shows. We opened the show with it. It was all over the internet. Talk about the importance of the internet now and the social networking and saving these kids' lives.
I'll tell you what, it's huge. The way we investigate is we go out, we blanket an area. Through Kathy Ann and Stephanie, they kind of coordinate our social networking side. They get us volunteers. They target local areas like Salt Lake City or Logan or Ogden. They find volunteers in those communities to come out and help us go out and talk to the businesses and give them flyers. Social networking, really, we couldn't do it without it. I mean, as far as locating leads, fellow friends, the fraternities, sororities are huge in getting the word out for us. It's really hard to hide in a college community because the colleges or the fraternities and sororities are so great at getting the word out that you can't hide there anymore. So you have to go back into the regular community and stay away from the universities. But, yeah, we're just really getting to understand how big the effort is on Facebook, Twitter, internet, emails. I mean, working stuff through Missing Exploited Children and all the other organizations. I mean, there's probably 100 people. I did say I was traveling on my way to Wisconsin, so. But
are you still there?
Yeah, I'm just hoping that the announcement goes over quick. But we couldn't do what we do without our volunteers. And there's so many out there that get the flyers out, use their friends to get the word out. In this Katie Allison case, the mom was amazing. How she assembled people right off the beginning. She contacted all the people, Missing Exploited Children, organizations in California, and, I mean, just everywhere, and blanketed the United States. And then she got connected with our volunteers, with Kathy Ann, and Kathy Ann really went, I mean, beyond I mean, what normal people do. And he just tirelessly kept putting the posters out. And Stephanie actually came out to volunteer and came out to Ogden, Utah, and helped distribute flyers and work with the volunteers there. So, you know, volunteers are the only way that we can do this. I mean, there's no way that any parent can afford to pay for a recovery effort, whether it's a local one or a national one like Katie Allison is. So the volunteers are huge.
And Susan?
Yes.
Susan, yeah, a lot of times, you know, I know from dealing with the police on these matters, they really like it when another agency, I know I've done a lot of runaways through my business here, you know, a 14-year-old girl that has taken off with the 17-year-old boyfriend that the parents didn't allow her to see. And, you know, you get the cooperation, obviously, of the parents. You try to, they let you search her room. You find out who her best friend is. You go to the best friend's house. The parents of that best friend sit down with you, put a little pressure on the girlfriend. You know, Mary's in trouble. We don't know where she is. The parents are crying. Please help Mr. Colucci over here. Where is she? And I tell you, more times out of not, they give you the information. You're able to go even sometimes to another state, retrieve that person. Meanwhile, the parents are en route to meet you there. And we even had a young boy that what we did was he was off his medication and we didn't know where he went. And finally we notified all the police departments across the country just with a picture to be on the lookout for this kid. And what they did was they saw him about 3 a.m. down in Florida, just laying in on the side of a building, laying near a door over there. And what they did under the pretext of vagrancy or disorderly conduct, just kind of brought him in and kept him there till his father got there. So, I mean, the police, being an ex-cop myself, they don't want to get involved in too many of these things, you know. So I know when I show my face, they're happy that I'm getting involved because that's something they don't have to worry about. And I'm sure our guest sees that through his agency, too.
That's correct.
Jason, let me just update you on something that's going on in our chat room. Obviously, you're not in there. Our director of research, Kim Colton, sent a comment I guess I should deliver to you. And she's in the area in Wisconsin. She said she hopes you're bringing your long underwear. Apparently, it's a little bit chilly. And she's also volunteered to be a volunteer. So perhaps you'll going back and forth with Kathy Ann as we speak, and maybe you'll end up meeting Kim when you get to Wisconsin.
That'd be great. I'm actually probably right now about 6-8 hours away from being in Chicago, so I'm definitely looking to get running as soon as I get there.
Great. One other thing I was curious about, you said that you get what you think is a relatively small percentage of the sex trade trafficking situations. Do you get much call or involved with, custodial interference, where in divorce situations where someone with visitation doesn't return the child, absconds with the child, or that type of situation where you pretty much know who took the child and you got to try to retrieve them from the absent parent? Do you ever run into those types of cases?
That's probably about half of what we do is work with the custodial interference or the parental abduction. We don't really work with the stranger abductions because law enforcement has that pretty much under control. They're looking for prosecution, and there's a lot of elements there that we try to stay out of and stay out of the way. But we do provide some support to local law enforcement in those areas, like resources that we can get quicker than they can through their traditional methods. And we have a huge, as private investigators, our sources are what makes us successful. So, I mean, we generally, if we're working at a national level, we have a lot of resources that we can aid law enforcement in, and we get calls from time to time for those.
And one thing I'd like to have our listeners understand, Jason, is that, you know, you mentioned before about, you know, sometimes charging or getting some kind of money. I want our listeners to realize we are not talking about Jason and Teen Track becoming very rich over this stuff. The man is in a car right now traveling to 0 degree temperature to do his work. And, I mean, I appreciate that. I appreciate agencies of this nature that is putting one kid back where they're supposed to be and helping them. So I just want to, you know, give kudos to you, because this is not a millionaire. This ain't not going to make you a millionaire, and you do this, and you do great work. And I just wanted to acknowledge you before we run out of time.
I think people are not understanding of any kind of work like this, whether it be this or crimes or, you know, that or you know, unsolved cases. And people don't understand what goes into this, and they don't understand the amount of time. They don't understand that you have to turn on your plumbing and your lights as well. And you know, I would suggest, too, that maybe you start, I don't know if you work with the PTAs across the country. Is PTA still around?
Yes.
The parent, okay. That you have them, you know, almost help you do fundraisers and different things and help you do awareness campaigns, because the parents don't know you exist. The parents, you know, if there's that information in the schools, they're likely to know that it's there and act on it. And you know, I think the PTA is a great way to do that, to get your resources on all of their websites as well, as a suggestion.
Right. Well, and the big thing I want the listeners to understand is this is a huge issue. Runaways, you know, Phoenix police have 3,000 runaways on the street at any given time. And that's just the city of Phoenix. And I saw some stat from Runaway Switchboard that 1 out of 7 teenagers will run away. I mean, most of them, we all acknowledge, will come back within 24 to 48 hours. But 1 in 7 kids, I mean, we know 7 teenagers, so we know one of them are going to run away, if not more. I mean, it's a huge, huge problem right now, I mean, across the country. And there's so many predators out there, not just sex, but for everything else, that will exploit these children. And it's such a huge issue for us to get them back fast, so they don't have a lot of damage done to them, whether it's criminal charges or pregnancy or sexual diseases. I mean, whatever it may be, sooner we can get them back with the parents or back with professionals that can help them, reunite them back to their family or back to society, it's huge. I mean, we've got to do that, because what we can do is we can actually reduce some crimes, some juvenile crimes, as well as, I mean, just, I mean, really help the parents and the team.
Jason,
is it because of the instant gratification? Go ahead, I'm sorry, Dan.
I was just going to say, what do you do if you're successful and you find the child you're looking for, and you catch up with the 14-year-old, and he or she says, I don't care, I'm not going back. I didn't like it at home. I still prefer what I'm doing out on the street or whatever to going back to that house. What happens then? What's the action that you can or can't take at that point?
Well, at that point, law enforcement does get involved. They will hold the child for the parents to come down. That's where the counseling and the professionals in the counseling community come in. We don't really do a lot of we don't do any crisis intervention. I'm not trained for it. I'm not licensed to do it. We track kids, find them, get them into a safe environment, then allow the parents and their professionals to come in, or people that we refer to come in and try to work through the problem. And if the problem doesn't work, then we can become the transport agent and transport the child to a treatment program, to a boarding school, whatever the professional and the parent feels it's necessary to reunite the family.
We are out of time, guys. This other half hour went by very fast. Then I want to thank you so much, and we're going to have you back on. And we want to let everybody know that CrimeWire is taking a break for the holidays, and we return to the airwaves on Tuesday, January 4th, 2011. Thank you to the CrimeWire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, and public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be January 4th, 2011. Tune in as we analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. And you can hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show at www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically...
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard. When there is nowhere else to turn, visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. To everyone, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, and the lovely Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night.
Good night.
Good night, everyone.